As more and more New Yorkers get vaccinated every day, an obvious question is emerging. What's next? What's next for traveling? What's next for indoor activities? What's next for masks? What's next for kids? What's next? What's next? What's next? To begin to answer some of those questions and explain why we may not have all those answers for weeks, if not months, we're joined once again by Dr. Eli Rosenberg, a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics for the University of Albany and a member of Governor Andrew Cuomo's Vaccine Distribution and Implementation Task Force. So I want to start by getting the lay of the land as it pertains to the state of the pandemic in New York. So how many daily new infections, hospitalizations, and deaths are we seeing now? And is there any sort of previous point in the pandemic that is comparable to where we're at now?
Yeah, I think those are really important to keep in mind, actually. So I'll just answer your first questions. We're at a little under 8,000 infections per day. Our most recent day of reporting was about 7,800 new infections, 84 deaths. And our test positivity was 3.6% of tests coming back positive. So just for some context, these kind of metrics and other ones on cases, hospitalizations, bring us to about where we were in early December, about the first days of December. And that's, if, as you recall, was sort of when we were on the way up, ramping up for that big winter wave that we just came through. So we're not out of the woods, actually.
But as opposed to then, are we at least trending downwards as opposed to upwards?
Well, we were trending downwards. We've actually hit somewhat of a plateau here in New York. There's lots of different names that have been floated for it, but it's really a high plateau. But basically, we've leveled out. Maybe we're increasing a little bit, and it's at a high level. We never really bottomed out after this winter wave.
So last week, federal health officials released new data about the efficacy of the two-shot vaccine dose regimens from Moderna and Pfizer, which was very encouraging in terms of the levels of protection for the immunized person and the people they come in contact with. Can you walk us through what some of the latest research shows us?
I think the recent results from CDC are really exciting. What makes them different, this study different from some of the other contexts, is they're not a clinical trial results. These are from a real-world effectiveness study, vaccines deployed in the real world, in this case to healthcare workers. And what CDC did, which is different than the clinical trials, is they actively tested everybody in the study every week and to look at not just disease that people feel, you know, are symptomatic or are hospitalized with, but to really look at underlying infection at all, including asymptomatic infection. And what they found was that after two shots, people were protected 90% against any infection, including the asymptomatic ones. If you recall from the Pfizer and Moderna trials, they had found 95 and 94% efficacy for symptomatic disease, and here we're looking at 90% for infection at all. And that's really encouraging. And they also found 80% effectiveness 2 weeks after one shot, which is really also exceptionally high protection even in the days after that first shot. So it's all very exciting. And I think it's in some sense, verify some other results that were coming out of Israel or from some nursing facilities here in the U.S. But this is really the broadest information we have about real-world conditions for actual infection. And this can tell us not just about your protection, but really starts to illuminate protection to the community. Because now we're starting to see where vaccines may be protecting against the ability to transmit to others.
Yeah, do we have any good numbers on that? I know from reading the New York Times story about this research, they didn't use necessarily, you know, figures to describe it. They used, you know, a narrative terms. They said, you know, it's rare transmission from people who have been vaccinated. How would you quantify it?
I would say that we still don't have the full evidence yet. I think this newest study is the closest, best data I've seen published out in the real in the literature yet. And what I mean by that is, you know, we have this evidence that the vaccine prevents you from developing symptomatic illness, severe illness, and now infection altogether. But we haven't been able to show that it altogether stops you from, you know, having small amounts of virus in your body and transmitting it from somebody else. That kind of study is actually very complicated. I would like to see studies where you have vaccinated persons that are in the study, and then they're unvaccinated close contacts, and you get to demonstrate that those unvaccinated contacts were protected by the other guy who got, or gal who got vaccinated. And that's a very complex study to do, but that would be the ultimate study to show what we want to show here, which is the ceasing of transmission. That's a very pie-in-the-sky study. We will see results like that come out, I think for now, like the results like the one that we just talked about, showing that asymptomatic infection isn't happening is very much along the pathway of what we need to see to be able to say, okay, transmission probably is also being reduced.
Based on the evidence that has been collected, then, what does it mean to you that people should be allowed to do if they are vaccinated and they are, say, with other people that are vaccinated? Is it time to have, you know, the maskless barbecue? You know, can we have people inside our homes that aren't wearing masks? What are your takes on this?
So let me start by putting back out what CDC's current position is. Basically, right now, what CDC is currently recommending is that it's okay for fully vaccinated persons to be indoors with other fully vaccinated persons without masks or without keeping that 6-foot distance. But in other settings, everyone needs to wear masks, keep distance, even those vaccinated. So that means I'm vaccinated, you're vaccinated. We go to the movies, guess what? We're wearing masks. We're keeping the distances that are required. So there's some nuance here, right? In these private settings, they feel that we have enough evidence to say that it's safe to be together, without masks and distance, but we could still have to keep our vigilance up in many other settings. And so the question, and you might ask, well, why is that? Why is this distinction taking place? Why are we doing this? I think it's because, you know, vaccines don't provide 100% protection. When we talk about 90% efficacy, we're talking about 90% of protections, and 90% of persons are fully protected, but 10% of the time they may not be. And so there's going to be some instances where transmission will still occur, even if you're vaccinated. And now if you put lots of people who are vaccinated in a crowd with no masks, and maybe mix in a few people who aren't vaccinated, you can still have substantial transmission. So in very controlled small settings, we can start to let up. But in the crowded settings, especially with community transmission still so high, having people that don't have 100% protection, you know, anything less is going to be a little tricky. We're still in the complicated moment, and we really can't fully let up, particularly in public settings.
We're talking about what's next for New Yorkers who are vaccinated against COVID-19, and our guest is Dr. Eli Rosenberg, a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics for the University of Albany and a member of Governor Andrew Cuomo's Vaccine Distribution and Implementation Task Force. What about travel for people who have been vaccinated? I know I'm looking forward to getting on a plane and potentially going to the Southwest in the fall. Is that something that I can do sooner than later once I've completed my regimen of the vaccine?
Well, I still think in a personal sense that we need to just all be careful with the types of risks we're taking. The CDC issued a statement April 2nd,
right,
updating its current, you know, travel guidance and basically saying that people who, you know, are fully vaccinated can travel without necessarily needing to test or quarantine as long as they adhere to other precautions. And I think that's fine, but I do think we do want to be a little careful about sending signals at large that sort of we're back to where we used to be, right? That COVID's over, you know, it's back to January 2020, and we let the good times roll, you know, because I think even that even if the messaging is targeted towards vaccinated people, there may be a sense of sort of openness given at large, and that might sweep up unvaccinated people who feel like, oh, COVID's over. And I think we have to be very careful with how we tailor our messaging. I do think it's a little ambitious just to say, well, let's resume travel, even in this targeted way, because of the messages it can send.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about the messaging of it. And this is something you and I have discussed sort of offline and online, is that issue of, you know, the broadest possible message you can send out there. And that while, you know, like you're saying, if you're vaccinated, you know, there are sort of rules and procedures you can follow, but it's that mindset that we need to kind of maintain until we are actually, you know, in the end zone or whatever sports metaphor you want to use with regards to this pandemic, right?
No, I agree. It's really, it's a high wire act. I think a fair criticism of these various CDC guidelines is we're asking the average citizen who's not necessarily thinking about all of the nuances of COVID and all the behaviors associated with it, like a day in, like out, like I am. We're asking them to sort of balance and juggle a lot. It's a very big burden to sort of keep track of, oh, okay, I'm in this situation, so therefore I can do that. even if some of the recommendations are scientifically correct, at some point it becomes a lot for people to juggle on top of all the other, you know, things that people are thinking about on a day-to-day basis. And so it's tricky to get these guidelines right and get them targeted correctly. And I do feel like the travel one is going a little too far.
This week, all New Yorkers 16 and up are eligible for a COVID-19 vaccination. What do we know about the effectiveness of the vaccine on younger teens, below 16? And do you expect there will be a future emphasis on getting them vaccinated, like in advance of the new school year in the fall?
So Pfizer, their product has been tested and approved for 16 to 17-year-olds. Moderna and Johnson & Johnson, not yet. But it's important that no vaccines are approved for the under 16 population. We have the least evidence for this age group. Now, Pfizer made a recent announcement saying that their ongoing studies have shown strong protection for the 12 to 15-year-old group. That hasn't been independently evaluated yet. And it's important to keep in mind as well that study has showed a very low number of infections at all, even in the placebo arm, a total of 18. The results were going to be a little uncertain and, you know, given the small number of outcomes. Given that I just said all that, the under 18 population represents 22% of Americans. Now, we haven't really touched on the idea of herd immunity yet, but if we don't have our children vaccinated, that means the maximum amount of our population that we'll ever, you know, achieve immunization for is 78%, right? If we 22% are children, 78 are not children. So we have an upper bound on where we could ever possibly get. If we vaccinated 100% of adults, we're still talking 78% of society. Children are going to have to be part of the equation. Even though we know they're somewhat less likely to acquire and transmit this virus, I still think that vaccinating children will be essential to opening society. Definitely, I would like to see that become part of our expectations for the school year if we have vaccines approved in time for this age group. That's a big if.
And after a quick break, we'll continue our discussion with Dr. Eli Rosenberg, a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at the University of Albany and a member of the governor's COVID-19 vaccine distribution task force.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
We're continuing our conversation about the COVID-19 vaccine rollout and what it means for a return to normalcy in New York. And our guest is Dr. Eli Rosenberg, a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at the University at Albany and a member of the governor's COVID-19 vaccine distribution task force. So before the break, you brought up the idea of herd immunity. Is there a rate where you feel like we've hit that number? Because I know a lot of numbers have been kicked around during the process, and each epidemiologist seems to have their own idea. But is there a rate where you'd feel comfortable saying we've achieved herd immunity?
Oh, geez. So I think you've correctly hit on that. There really is no sort of magic number. We've heard 70, we've heard 80, we've heard 90%, and so forth. And I think it's important to understand, first of all, why is that? Why are we saying numbers all over the place for this idea of herd immunity? And just to define herd immunity, it's this idea that once we vaccinate a certain percent of the population, we provide an indirect benefit to everybody who's not vaccinated. We protect them, and ultimately transmission, you know, grinds closer to a halt. And so why is this number all over the place? And it's really a number of factors. And I think the two big ones that are unknown that are on the table right now are the mix of the variants that are circulating in the population and how long previous infection protects you. So, for example, if 20% of my population has been infected and they have some immunity, they might be protected for a while even if they're not vaccinated. And so that can give you a free boost, as it were, towards achieving your immunity. Now, that first piece that I mentioned, the mix of variants, well, it turns out that the faster spreading variants, like the B117, that UK originating strain, if you have more faster spreading strains, it actually means that you have to achieve a higher percent of coverage of your vaccine to get to herd immunity. So imagine on the old, you know, the original strains of this virus, maybe it would have been 75%. We could be talking 90% if B117 is the one that's the predominant strain. And that's sort of a classic mathematical equation, that the faster spreading strains need higher levels of coverage. So this is an evolving story, how much of these strains is circulating you know, it's an ongoing story, and we're seeing around the world that these faster spreading strains are coming to dominate. And that means, well, guess what? We're out of luck. We're going to need higher levels of vaccine coverage. I think as a final piece on herd immunity, I think it's important not to fixate on it. It's truly a secondary benefit, right? This idea that we're using vaccinated persons to protect the unvaccinated one. The primary reason to get vaccinated is to protect you, the person for receiving the vaccine. And we have a high likelihood of doing that. We know we have good data on that. And I think we do, you know, herd immunity is nice, but we got to remember that the point of the vaccine is truly to protect you directly.
Could herd immunity dictate when we can start leading, you know, a maskless life again out in public?
Maybe. I think the common dialogue has sort of gone that way. Like, that's definitely like a narrative that you hear about, but I'm not sure they're so connected. So what I think makes life safe again is when transmission goes down to some level that we all deem acceptable. Not many new cases, not many hospitalizations, deaths, and so forth. That's what matters. Herd immunity, maybe not so much. Just for example, we didn't necessarily have herd immunity from influenza immunization, but you might have felt personally not at risk because you yourself were vaccinated. What makes us feel that confidence is keeping cases down.
So when can I go bowling and not wear a mask?
We need to be in a much better place than where we're at as a state and as a country. Our levels of transmission are still way unacceptably too high. Hundreds and hundreds of deaths a day, thousands of cases a day is not where we want to be as a country. So it's going to be sometime in the future. Herd immunity, truly, to reach back to that, is a concept that's nice to have. It's also, it exists along a gradient. It's not like you cross a threshold and then, bam, it disappears. That's usually not how it works. We'll always have smoldering outbreaks unless you have true eradication of the virus, which is something we don't do very frequently in public health. We get numbers low. We often don't eradicate.
Do you want to assign a specific transmission rate for when I can begin working on my perfect game again without a mask?
Ooh, that's hard. That's hard to pin down. I think it's because it's not just keep getting the numbers low. We've done that before, but it's sustaining that low, right? And we haven't been able to do that beyond a few months, right? We had, just to take New York, for example, we had a very low point in the summer. Just to see a resurgence in the fall and winter. So I don't know if there's a magic threshold. I think it's going to be the intersection of low case numbers, high levels of vaccine coverage, and being able to sustain this, and sustaining it during a time where we're easing up restrictions and saying, okay, well, we let more people go bowling, and transmission stayed low, so okay, we can ease up a little bit more. But I don't think there's a magic formula yet.
It seems like every day we're learning more about the COVID-19 vaccine as we have more time to study it, case in point being the updated information at the end of March that we talked about. At what point do you think we'll have a good sense of whether we need, for example, a booster shot of the vaccine in order to maintain our protection or to be protected against, you know, variants the way we are like the flu?
That's important, and you highlighted some of the key uncertainties there. So I'll say there's many studies going on right now of the vaccines from on the manufacturer side, independent researchers, government agencies like the CDC that we talked about, all trying to understand how the vaccine works in different settings and over time as well. And particularly, as you said, there's the potential, theoretically, for a declining in immunity or for the rise of new mutations that may sort of get around our current regimen of vaccines. And both of those are sort of scary thoughts. So we have lots of work going on here. Now, I'll say, like, most vaccines provide rather durable protection for years, 5, 10 years, lifetime. So I feel like just looking at how our track record at producing vaccines that last for a while, I feel pretty good about that. It's really about the new strains and variants that I would be most concerned about. Right. The reason you need new influenza vaccines every year is because the circulating strains are changing. That's why we need those annual boosters of influenza. As we don't control our epidemic enough, fast enough, and let more strains arise that may get around our vaccines that we currently have, that's where the fear comes in, particularly for me, for the need of changing up the formulation and needing boosters.
At least for now, demand for vaccinations is outpacing the supply, as eligible New Yorkers still have to wait, weeks to get their shot. When do you think the dynamic will flip and supply will exceed demand in New York?
I do think it's going to flip, right, that soon the supply will exceed demand. I think it's going to happen. It's going to happen soon. Just for example, President Biden has promised and seems to be on track for providing enough doses or making produced enough doses for everybody by the end of May. So that means by then we're going to have, you know, in theory, enough doses to get into people. Now, if you look at, for example, the New York Times, they have this figure, this graphic showing sort of another part of this equation, which is the pace, the daily pace of vaccinations. They have this very optimistic graph with a linear trend upwards, just going up, 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 and they show 90% by July. According to these two pieces, we're going to have all the doses that we need by May, and then everyone, that 90% of everyone's going to get them by July, which somehow does include those children that we talked about earlier. That's very unrealistic. Right, the idea that we would have keep seeing this linear increase all the way up as we get closer to 100%. At some point soon, it will begin to level off. I do think we're going to see in the May to June zone, we'll start to see a less than linear increase, and we'll start to flatten out. That there will be, we will struggle to bring enough people in to meet that 100% supply that we have. And then the game changes, right? Our hard work really dials up. It won't be as much about focusing on mass vaccination sites over time, but rather how we communicate and educate and build trust in the vaccine to ensure that communities and persons have access.
Well, we've been speaking with Dr. Eli Rosenberg. He's professor of epidemiology and biostatistics for the University at Albany and a member of Governor Andrew Cuomo's Vaccine Distribution and Implementation Task Force and hopefully a member of my bowling team in the future. Eli, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Happy to be here.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by Destiny USA. Shopping, dining, and entertainment all in one location. For more information, go to www.destinyusa.com.